Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2011 annual meeting. Our speaker is William Patry, Senior Copyright Counsel for Google. His session is entitled, How to Fix Copyright.
So I would say that the first thing we have to do in terms of figuring out for copyright is figuring out what it is we want copyright to do. And then figuring out how to do it. So Malcolm had mentioned this op-ed piece. And I was going to do something a little bit different today, but there was this op-ed piece by Scott Turow yesterday. And I thought, well, that's sort of the teachable moment, right? It's something that comes along that you can use. So I'm not sure if anyone can see it or if it's up there. Probably not. But Scott Turow did an op-ed piece yesterday. It was entitled, Would the Bard Have Survived the Web? There it is. The first thing about this is I don't get what's going on with the Mickey Mouse ears. I don't understand the connection between Shakespeare and Walt Disney. Scott Turow didn't do that. I'm sure the New York Times did. But I'm looking at that. If you have to sort of over-intellectualize, something happened there in the message. So I don't get the connection there. But Scott is actually testifying right now, I believe, before Congress, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, on a bill that involves the seizure of foreign, and perhaps domestic, we'll see, URLs that are supposedly for rogue sites, right? Sites that have unauthorized content up there. So this op-ed piece is sort of laying the groundwork, I think, for his testimony today. And he starts out, with a wonderful little historical thing here about archaeologists in 16th century London, and they discovered an experiment in the link between commerce and culture, and he uses the term paywalls, a nice little way of raising issues about paywalls for newspapers and other things here. But he's talking about physical paywalls, right? He's talking about people made some places where you could go, playhouses where you could go see plays, but you had to pay money to get into them, right? So he talks about Shakespeare's growing up at Stratford-on-Avon, and then these carpenters came, they built the first theater, and then there are other playhouses, but you couldn't get in unless you paid. And he talks about how at the end of the day, people would divide the money, and that, this money was an amazing thing, and that money changed everything, he says. Almost overnight, a wave of brilliant dramatists emerged, including Christopher Marlowe, Thomas Kidd, Ben Jonson, and Shakespeare. These talents and many considerable and lesser lights had found the opportunity, the conditions, and the money to pursue their craft. The conclusion he makes from this, of course, is that people won't do anything unless they make money. And I guess he also concludes that no one ever wrote a play before this occurred, too. He then makes the leap to contemporary times. And he talks about the stress on authors, that piracy is a lucrative, innovative, global enterprise, and that there are people overseas who are doing these secret things and stealing stuff. And then he mentions the hearing that he's testifying at this very moment. He then has this paragraph, which I love. It's probably on the next slide, that these terrible people who are doing terrible things are abetted by a handful of law professors and other experts who have made careers out of the fashioning counterintuitive arguments holding that copyright impedes creativity and progress. Their theory is that if we severely weaken copyright protections, innovation will truly flourish. It's a seductive thought, he adds, but it ignores centuries of scientific and technological progress based on the principle that a creative person should have some assurance of being rewarded for his innovative work. And you can go on and read the rest of it when you like. So when I read this, I thought, well, you know, Scott Turow, he's a pretty good author. I actually haven't read any of his stuff. But, you know, okay, I accept that he is. I actually testified with him once before Congress on Fair Use. That was at a time, I think, before he found truth. But when I was reading this yesterday, I thought, wow, that reminds me of another contemporary storyteller, actually somebody who lives about 5 miles from me. And that person is Glenn Beck. So I sort of wondered, you know, is Scott Turow the Glenn Beck of copyright? That's a question I asked myself. I thought, well, you know, there's probably some similarities there. First of all, Scott seems to have a very unique view of history and acts like, you know, he's done a lot of great historical research. I would imagine, you know, maybe today he'll have glasses on and a little pointer, maybe a blackboard that he can go to. There's a cabal of nefarious evildoers there. And, of course, there's always the imminent existential threat that's raised. So, I thought, well, yeah, maybe he is becoming the Glenn Beck of copyright. And I sort of recognized that possibility from having done some work on moral panics, which Malcolm had mentioned. So in the 1970s, there was a British sociologist named Stanley Cohen. And he was intrigued by the mods and rockers fights. Those of you who've watched the Austin Powers movies will, you know, recognize some of this. But they had, during bank holidays in England, you know, these different competing groups of mods and rockers would go out there and you know, dust it up with each other. And this caused, of course, proper British society a lot of, tension. And so Stanley Cohen came up with this idea of moral panics. Right? So moral panics are like false or rather exaggerated reactions to changes in society. And moral panics are caused by what he called folk devils. The original title of my book, which I really wanted, was called Metaphors, Moral Panics, and Folk Devils in the Copyright Wars. I thought that was a better title, a little more colorful. But my publisher said to me, well, it has to be really short. It has to be only this many characters. And I said, why? He said, because Amazon.com search engine only takes a certain number of characters. I said, well, I think it's a really great title. And they said, well, I think it is too. But, you know, you have to change it because that's the way Amazon search engine works. I said, you know, I work for a search engine company. Maybe they should improve their search engine rather than me have to give up a really good title. Of course, it didn't work out that way, and now I have really a lousy title. But folk devils is really a wonderful thing. And, you know, folk devils are the archetypal other, right, which we've always had. It's the bad people. It's people who aren't like us, people who are dangerously not like us, so that we have to do something as a society to protect ourselves. And we've always had these, if you want to go back to the Salem witch trials or, you know, whatever you like, perhaps President Obama for some Republicans. He could be a moral panic, but whatever your particular thing is, you've got these moral panics which are existential threats to society caused by people who are folk devils. And so because these people are really doing bad things, the government has to step in and do something about that. Now, you know, Scott Turow is a really wealthy, successful guy, but he apparently feels quite threatened by the Internet. And, of course, the solution is for the government to step in. The solution for the government is to step in and pass really stronger and stronger laws. Now, having worked in Congress, I have respect for the legislative process, and, you know, I think that laws, if they're effective, can do things. It's also true that the Internet has caused a lot of disruption to existing business models. But I would say that if we like innovation, guess what? That's what innovation is. Right? Innovation is disruptive. It's sort of an oxymoron to say that I want non-disruptive innovation. Either you want innovation or you don't. If you want innovation, then I think you have to accept that innovation is disruptive. It can challenge, it can render worthless or at least difficult existing business models, but at the same time, it also raises new opportunities. It may raise new opportunities for different people than you, so you may have a particularly negative view about the disruption, but that's just the way that innovation works. And it's difficult to make a transition from one type of business model from another. So, for example, for record companies, it's a difficult transition from selling CDs, where we have to buy 12 songs rather than the one or two we want. And so it's hard to actually have to sell people the one or two songs they want to. And you can complain that you're losing a lot of money, that you're trading analog dollars for digital dimes. So I understand that that's difficult. But the process of demonizing disruption, that disruption is an evil, terrible thing, is something that may be emotionally satisfying if you're on the short end of the innovation stick, but it doesn't really advance the ball at all. So when I read Scott's piece, I wondered, what does Shakespeare have to do with this, right? What does Shakespeare have to do with testimony today before the Senate on seizing URLs for foreign rogue sites? I think the answer is nothing, as far as I could tell. That has as much to do with that as the mouse ears do on Shakespeare. I just don't get the connection. I mean, first of all, Shakespeare lived before there was copyright. He lived before the Statute of Anne. And the sort of way that he made money is really rather different. I also questioned the idea that almost overnight, right, all of these brilliant playwrights came about. And you have to sort of wonder, well, were they just sort of lying around at home? Were they, they were brilliant. Of course, they were brilliant, because we were told they were brilliant. But were they just lying around doing something else, and then all of a sudden, once a playhouse was built, they said, well, okay, we can go make money, and here we are. Here are our works. I doubt that. And as I also questioned, I think there were people who wrote plays before those paywalls went up. Now, the part that I focused on for moral panics was this sort of group of law professors, web companies, and other undefined experts, right, who claim the copyright is a relic and who want to severely weaken copyright protection. That's what also sort of made me think of Glenn Beck, because that's the sort of moral panic and folk devils. You got the folk devils. Well, who are these bad people? These are bad people who say copyright is a relic and we've got to severely weaken it. I've actually never heard people who question copyright say, I'm going to wake up today and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that I can severely weaken copyright protection. There are really difficult questions about copyright, and you face them every day in decisions that you have to make. So I accept that they're very difficult questions. I, working for a company that's usually a defendant in litigation. In fact, I don't know that we've ever been a plaintiff. I know in copyright cases we've never been a plaintiff. We may have been one or two trademark cases, but certainly never in copyright. We're always the defendant. And putting out new products, they're really tough questions that you have to ask. So I get the part that they're difficult issues. But I don't think we solve them by sort of saying, well, the people who have a different solution than us, well, they think copyright's a relic, and they think that it should be severely weakened. I know I don't feel that way, and I know people that I work with don't feel that way. So I think we have to get past the sort of issue about moral panics. I also thought the Shakespeare one was a very funny example. One of the judges I know is Judge Posner, Richard Posner, who sits in the Seventh Circuit. He's actually written a lot about copyright. Those of you who are familiar with the Chicago School of Law and Economics know that he was one of the founders of that school, and I think he's would be regarded as generally a very pro-property person. He and perhaps others believe that owning private property is a great way to have an efficient marketplace and to make sure that resources are maximized. He's not one of these people who wants to severely undermine copyright. But he and William Landis, who also teaches at the University of Chicago, wrote a book about copyright, and they talked about Shakespeare. So when I read Scott Turow's thing about Shakespeare, I remembered what Judge Posner had said about Shakespeare. And here's what he said. It's pretty short. He was talking about the way that Shakespeare wrote. And I'm not telling you anything that you don't know already. I just wanted to use Judge Posner's words as fair use. I'm sure if I called him up, he'd let me do it anyway. But I think it's fair use. So here's what he said about Shakespeare. His characteristic mode of dramatic composition was to borrow the plot and most of the characters, and sometimes the actual language, from an existing work of history, biography, or drama, and to embroider the plot, add some minor characters, alter the major ones, and write most or commonly all of the dialogue. Such was the extent of borrowing by the Elizabethans that some of the plays would be classified by modern copyright lawyers as derivative works, which infringe the original unless the author of the original has authorized them. So the question that's asked here, would the bard survive the web? I think there's a more fundamental question, which is that would the bard have survived our modern copyright laws? Judge Posner doesn't think so. I actually think that's a real question and that we should answer. But the way that we should answer it is by figuring out for each other what we want copyright to do. Different people will have different solutions to that. And so we each will come to our own. But what I would like to see, this is the second part about how to fix copyright. The first part is for all of us as individuals, you know, to sort of figure out how we're going to approach things and what we want. The next way is to make it empirically based, right? To decide, this is what I want, and this is how we get there. And to date, I think it's true that copyright has been a faith-based enterprise, right? To go back to an earlier time. Jamie Boyle at Duke calls it an evidence-free zone. I would actually say that's true some of the time, but not all the time. I actually think we have an amazing amount of evidence sometimes, and it's just ignored. If you take term extension, for example, when in 1998 the United States extended the term of copyright by 20 years, there was evidence that would never increase a single work that would be created. To the contrary, it would inhibit the preservation of lots of works by libraries, archives, by public institutions, by nonprofit institutions. And the evidence for that was actually in a report that the Congressional Research Service did for Congress. It was there, but it was ignored. Even common sense would tell you that wasn't going to help anyone, right? At that time, the term of protection was life of the author plus 50 years, 50 years after you die. Now it's life of the author plus 70 years. But you would have to say, well, okay, why are we doing those extra 20 years? Why are we giving people 20 more years? The answer, the ideological answer, the unexamined answer would be, well, we want to encourage people to create more works. So I would say, okay, that's the ideological answer, but let's actually examine it. Is there a single human being in the entire earth who sits down and says, first of all, I'm going to write only if there's copyright law. I'm not going to write unless there's copyright law. And the copyright law that's there of my life plus 50 years, you know, that's just not enough. I'm not writing unless there's 20 more years after I die. I mean, that's just absurd. It's not true. And it has not been true since then, of course. And what has happened is that we have impeded the preservation efforts for stuff that the large companies don't want to put out. I understand why they don't want to put out historical things, because they operate on a really good profit margin, a high profit margin. They have high costs. And so it doesn't make sense economically. I would say, okay, that's fine. Then let other people do it. Right? Don't use your copyright to block people who actually want to do things. If you don't want to exploit it, that's fine. That's the way the free market works. I get that, and I accept that, and I think it's fine. But what's not fine is to believe that we're going to pass laws that will do things that they don't do, and in fact, are harmful. And I have to say, to date, our copyright laws have only been faith-based. They have only been ideologically based on what we believe they do, but they don't do it. Now, that's actually not the fault of law. It's the fault of the people who enact laws, right? Copyright law has been overpromised from the beginning. It has never done, I think, what most people think they wanted to do, which is to have diverse offerings, to have lots of different authors, to improve our cultural heritage widely, and to have, you know, as many people writing as possible. It's always been a winner-take-all system because that's the economics of it. It's always been the case that we've had gatekeepers, and gatekeepers make money by scarcity, not by abundance, right? You control the number of works that are out so that people have to buy from you. You don't have as many works out as possible because you don't make as much money. So this idea that copyright leads to abundance, I think, is actually empirically false. And so I've done a lot of studying on that. I don't blame copyright law for that. We're asking it to do something, in fact, that the system won't do. So if those things are important, and I believe they are important, we have to find other ways to achieve those goals. So I don't believe that it is severely undermining copyright to make it perform in a way that we say it's supposed to do. And if it can't do that, then we find other ways to come to those objectives. So I was very heartened that for the Grammys, that Justin Bieber lost for best, you know, new artist. Not because I don't like him. I think he's a commercial product. He started on YouTube, which is great for my employer, and that was a wonderful thing. And I hope he makes as much money as possible and finds true love and, you know, has a huge house. Totally fine with me. I don't get it, but I'm not 16. So that's fine. That's the way the market works. That is the winner-take-all market, right? I was happy, of course, that he lost to Esperanza Spalding, whose work I knew, and whose I regard as a real musician. Right? She was on the faculty of the Berklee School of Music when she was 20, and I knew her before two nights ago. Actually, not my style of music, but I appreciate that she's a real musician, a great musician, and so I thought that award was really fantastic. Will she become Justin Bieber in terms of economic popularity because of that? No, never. I don't think so. That would be great, but I don't think so. Now, is that the fault of copyright? I don't think so either, right? The way that the market works is that it rewards people like Justin Bieber because that's the way it works. That's why before Tiger Woods' indiscretions were known, he had the lion's share of endorsements. You know, it's the superstar system. It's sort of the lone genius system where, you know, copyright becomes something that furthers commodities. That's the way the system is. And it's not a knock on the system. It's just acknowledging that that's what it is. So in terms of fixing copyright, I would say the last thing I would add, and I'll stop here so you can make comments, is that we have to accept the market for what it is and not complain that it's something it's not. But if we want those things it doesn't do, we have to figure out another way to do it. And governments, I would say, have been outsourcing cultural heritage. They say, oh, well, we can rely on the free market, right? The free market will express what people want, and we don't have to spend government funds on arts institutions, on educational institutions, on training kids. I have 9.5-year-old twins, as I mentioned. My daughter is a clarinetist. I buy tons of sheet music. I'm really keenly interested in how you further creativity in children and others. I can say copyright's not the way it's done. So if we want those things, and I pray that we do because I very much do, it's not going to be copyright. So we have to actually spend money. We can't rely on the free market to do stuff the free market's not going to do. So my response to Scott is no. It's not severely weakening copyright to say it can do X but not Y. If we want it to do X and Y, we have to figure out the way to do both. That's not to say we're not going to have copyright, but it's going to say we have to have those other things. And if copyright gets in the way of those other things, then copyright has to give. That's where I am right now. Where I'll be tomorrow, I don't know, but it'll be fun to figure it out. Thank you so much.
You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. Thanks for listening.